Jumbo set. Back to Coleman. Over the top. No doubt about this one. Touchdown, Washington.
Oh, I love the toughness.
Oh, boy.
Ouch.
Were we surprised by that? Oh, my goodness. The Huskies had essentially given away two previous football games. I would argue the Apple Cup and then their follow-up.
Rutgers.
New Jersey.
Piscataway, New Jersey.
Anyway, New Brunswick, Jersey. Bottom line is I thought the Huskies were just going to get walloped because Rutgers and Washington State are good teams, but they're not a top 10 team. And Michigan was, and they defeated us by 20 points last January, and almost our entire roster was gone. So we had to build up quite literally from the ground up, and here we are facing Michigan again. And we beat them? We beat them. I don't know if there's ever been a celebration for a football game that did not result in a Rose Bowl berth. But, you know, back in the day when the Pac-12 and then before then the Pac-10 and the Pac-8 played for the Rose Bowl to get into the Rose Bowl. But, no, it was just incredible. Anyway, we'll talk about that next hour here with our senior sports correspondent, Matthew Carlson.
National TV, John, NBC, you can't beat it. Anybody who had doubts in the Big Ten that, oh, the Huskies, they're not that good. They shouldn't be in this division.
How'd they get on this?
Ta-da!
How'd they get a primetime game?
I think they just proved
the
point.
But anyway, there is a whole lot of stuff going on. Donald Trump returned to Butler, Pennsylvania. He said, Butler, Pennsylvania, why does that stand out? That is the place where he was shot. The very place he was shot, damn near killed, in mid-July by a gunman who was somehow allowed to perch on the roof of a building 150 yards away or less. Unbelievable. Anyway, he returns in triumph. And he brought Elon Musk with him. And we're going to play his remarks here in just a couple of minutes, what Elon Musk had to say. But there was just a massive crowd. I saw one estimate was 100,000. I don't know if it was really 100,000.
Really? Wow.
But it was huge because it was history. And what else is making news is this, of course, is the October 7th edition of the radio program of record, the John Carlson Show. October 7th is the one-year anniversary of the invasion of Israel by Hamas and the barbaric murder, sadistic torture and murder of 1,200 people, another 200 to 250 people taken hostage. Many of them have since died. Some have been released. They still hold over 100. Not sure if they're alive. But this came up in a interview that Kamala Harris held over the weekend with Bill Whitaker from CBS. So the Harris-Walls strategy of being able to campaign from the basement the way that Joe Biden pulled off 4 years ago, they can't do that this time out. And they realize it. So Tim Walz actually went on Fox News Sunday with Shannon Bream. And Kamala Harris sat down for a one-on-one with relatively gentle, easygoing Bill Whitaker, but he asked some relevant questions. And one of them, again, which has been released. That for some reason, the entire interview has not been released, and 60 Minutes was not on last night.
But, I believe it's supposed to air tonight.
Yes.
Not quite sure why, but...
Well, right, I think it's the one-year anniversary. Plus, but it's going up against Monday Night Football, so we'll see how many people watch it. But anyway, she was asked about Israel. And her answers were very revealing, not just what she said, but how she said it. Again, this Bill Whitaker with Kamala Harris last night.
We supply Israel with billions of dollars in military aid. Mm-hmm. And yet Prime Minister Netanyahu seems to be charting his own course. The Biden-Harris administration has pressed him to agree to a ceasefire. He's resisted. You urged him not to go into Lebanon. He went in anyway. He has promised to make Iran pay for the missile attack, and that has the potential of expanding the war. Does the U.S. have no sway over Prime Minister Netanyahu?
The aid that we have given Israel allowed Israel to defend itself against 200 ballistic missiles that were just meant to attack the Israelis and the people of Israel. And when we think about the threat that Hamas, Hezbollah presents, Iran, I think that it is without any question our imperative to do what we can to allow Israel to defend itself against those kinds of attacks.
Okay, so far so good. But now, instead of saying, you know, they have a right to defend themselves, they have a right to vanquish their enemies, listen to where she goes from here.
Now, the work that we do diplomatically with the leadership of Israel is an ongoing pursuit around making clear our principles, which include the need for humanitarian aid, the need for this war to end, the need for a deal to be done, which would release the hostages and create a ceasefire. And we're not going to stop.
Okay, so what if a ceasefire doesn't end the war? What if a ceasefire prolongs the war? Every time Israel has their opponents, whether it's Hamas in Gaza or Hezbollah up north in Lebanon, every time they have them on the ropes, we rush in and call for a ceasefire. The ceasefire gives the enemies of Israel time to regroup, time to rearm. So our principles, as she puts them, are colliding with each other. If we had not pressured Israel to earlier ceasefires, remember, at one point, we actually withheld a delivery of several bombs. If we had not done that, if we had told Israel, vanquish Hamas, end Hamas as a threat, finish them, this war would have been over months ago in Gaza. Now, it's going to end relatively soon because Hamas in Gaza, that's the strip of land to the southwest of Israel, it's almost over. All that really remains is getting the hostages back and finishing off the most notorious terrorist in the Middle East, next to Hassan Nasrallah, who is the 30-year head of Hezbollah, the most notorious terrorist and arguably even more vicious than Nasrallah, is Yahya Sinwar. He's the bin Laden of Hamas. And he actually looks like Central Casting sent the guy. He looks like an evil fanatic. This is the architect of October 7th. He's still alive. Israel's going to kill him. They're not going to be arresting him and having him tried before an international tribunal. They're taking him out. They're done with this guy. But he's still believed to be alive. Nasrallah is dead. His second in command is dead. I think the second in command to the guy who was second in command is gone. So if we had simply allowed Israel to complete their work, they would have been done. We, the United States, have prolonged the war and the violence. And it's all because they're trying to have it both ways. They don't want to lose Jewish support, so they say Israel has a right to defend itself. They don't want to lose Muslim support in America, particularly in the state of Michigan, where there are more Muslims than Jews. So they talk about a ceasefire. This is all calibrated to the election calendar, which is why, again, you have two of their, quote, principles colliding with each other. So Kamala knows that Benjamin Netanyahu, because he has prosecuted this war, is really unpopular, not only with the pro, quote, air quotes, pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas, pro-Hezbollah crowd, but also with a lot of American liberals, with the political left, and even some liberal Jews. So she refused to call him an ally. I'm not making this up. Have a listen.
But it seems that Prime Minister Netanyahu is not listening.
Well, Bill, the work that we have done has resulted in a number of movements in that region by Israel that were very much prompted by or a result of many things, including our advocacy for what needs to happen in the region.
Does anyone know what she just said, by the way? No, me neither. Anyway, let's continue.
Do we have a real close ally in Prime Minister Netanyahu?
I think, with all due respect, the better question is, do we have an important alliance between the American people and the Israeli people? And the answer to that question is yes.
No, that's not a better question. That's a complete evasion. We are dealing with a government. We're not dealing with the populace at large. The populace at large elected Benjamin Netanyahu to keep them safe. A lot of Jews are unhappy. They thought Netanyahu had been too easy on Hamas. Now, we tend to think that if Benjamin Netanyahu is unpopular in Israel, it's because they think he's been too hard line, because American liberals think he's been too hard line. Actually, in Israel, they're furious with him for allowing Hamas to get as powerful as they got. So she's refused. So she says a better question. That's not a better question. That's an evasion and a distraction. She's refusing to call Benjamin Netanyahu an ally on the one-year anniversary of October 7th. Think about that. I am so embarrassed for my country right now that we have people like this governing it. Here's the downside of her remarks in Israel. They don't trust us anymore. America is supposed to be the leader. The leader, the beacon, the example. Israel doesn't trust us. Israel knows that this fight ultimately is not about Hamas, the terror group down south, and it's not about Hezbollah, the terror organization up north that Israel is eviscerating. This is ultimately about Iran. Both Hamas and Hezbollah don't do anything violent. They don't do anything aggressive against Israel without a green light and maybe even an order from Iran. This is since October 7th and even long before. These are attacks on Israel by Iran through proxies. Israel is annihilating their proxies. And Israel is going to turn to the ultimate provocateur, which is racing toward developing a nuclear weapon, which they have said they will drop on Israel. And Israel will have the final word here. So that's what you need to keep your eye on. Israel is going to get to the source of all of the chaos, bedlam, and terrorism, whether it's the Houthi rebels, Hamas, Hezbollah. They're going to get to the bottom of it by taking the fight to Iran. Not a land invasion, but watch them go after their nuclear forces, their nuclear program. And when they do, I have three words. Good for them.
John, I was just looking at some business news real quick here. $400 million cash on hand here for Harris and Tim Walz. They need more, they say, to really beef up advertising here in November. Tim Walz will be in Seattle tomorrow. No public event. It just says private fundraising event.
Yes. He's meeting with the proletariat, the common people of Medina and Hunts Point. So that should be very interesting.
Is he going to give them FEMA money? Is that what's going to happen?
Well, get ready for Philip J. Vandervoort III's first social media sweep of the week. What's going on in Twittersville?
Vice President Harris spoke on a female-oriented podcast. Apparently, it's an incredibly popular podcast. I had not been familiar with it, either the podcast name or the podcast host, before Kamala Harris went on for an interview, but it was one of those kind of predictable sort of softball-type interviews with a friendly interviewer. The social media sweep, sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. The podcast is called Call Her Daddy, and it's hosted by a woman named Alexandra Cooper.
Yes.
I was completely unfamiliar with this, but this is burning up
for
the
years.
Political circles of social media, including Twitter. And so the Kamala Harris campaign, on their social media handle, Kamala HQ for headquarters, posted a clip of a question that the podcast host asked Kamala Harris. And as I said, you know, it's a female-oriented podcast, so it's kind of like ladies talking to ladies.
Yeah.
And the question came up about, the podcast host asks, is there any law that gives the government the power to make a decision about a man's body? And the answer had a lot of people in conservative circles pointing to something that Vice President Kamala Harris missed. Here's the host.
One of the biggest conversations in this year's election revolves around a woman's body.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I want to take a moment, and can we try to think of any law that gives the government the power to make a decision?
I know what you're going to ask.
About a man's body. Let's
And yes, the answer is I can think of something right off the bat.
Exactly. And so this is, and again, you know, this is something that Kamala Harris's own campaign posted, was her response to this question. So I think you know where this is going, John. Why don't you go ahead and give the answer?
The answer is we're at war. You're drafted.
We'll need you
for the next 5 years.
Yeah.
Or for the next 3 years, whatever.
Yeah.
Men. So the answer is yeah.
Men at the age of 18 have to register for selective service. Is that what it's still called?
Yes.
Correct.
And I'm guessing that Kamala Harris and the host, I forget her name.
Alexandra Cooper.
Yes. I guess she never quite figured this out. I mean, it took me 12 seconds during the question to figure out, I know where they're going, and I hope they're not thinking that there's no answer to this question, because there is, and it's a relatively simple one.
Yeah. So either they're in a rush to virtue signal to each other, there's nothing, or just this inability to think through the potential for a major war, major military situation that might require mobilizing American males.
Well, and then here's the other question. At what point would Kamala Harris or Alexandra Cooper acknowledge that there is another human, a baby, in the equation when you're talking about abortion? Is there a point in the pregnancy where they would say the government should now protect that life within the womb, because that's a baby in there, not a potential life, but it's a baby now? We're in the eighth month of pregnancy. Would they then allow the government to make a decision, quote, about a woman's body, because there's now another body that is a viable human being in there? Of course, that would actually require them to do a little bit of thinking, wouldn't it? About where do you draw a line? Surely there is a line to be drawn. All right. It is 6:30 on the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Donald Trump had 3 rallies in 3 days. Man, and those rallies go like 90 minutes, 2 hours sometimes. That's like he's on tour. anyway, what he had to say in Wisconsin, what Elon Musk, who appeared at his rally in Butler, Pennsylvania, had to say is the true test of leadership. That straight ahead, the Commute with Carlson continues. I got a couple of what I'll call side-by-side clips that you need to hear. They were, taking the same people speaking some distance apart. The first clip, and this has to do with the response of the Biden administration to the areas that have been absolutely devastated by Hurricane Helene. The first is a clip from the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. This was at the start of hurricane season. And whether or not they're going to be ready for it, here is what he had to say in July, not that long ago.
FEMA is tremendously prepared. This is what we do. This is what they do. And the key here, Rebecca, is also to make sure that the communities who are potentially impacted are prepared as well. And it's not just hurricanes and wildfires, also extreme heat, which certainly some parts of the United States are already experiencing.
Okay, there you go. They're ready for everything. Not just hurricane season, we're well prepared for that, well prepared, but also for things that could happen beforehand. All right, so here's Mayorkas last week.
Jerry, Alejandro Mayorkas sounding the alarm on FEMA funding right after the devastation of Hurricane Helene. Listen.
We are meeting the immediate needs.
With the money that we have, we are expecting another hurricane hitting. We do not have the funds. FEMA does not have the funds to make it through the season.
This all comes as the Biden-Harris administration spent over $1 billion from a FEMA program on services for migrants.
Oh. So instead of reallocating money from one part of FEMA's budget to the other, you spent it because, after all, you had all the funding you needed for hurricane relief. All the funding you need. One more time here from the top, just the first part.
FEMA is tremendously prepared. This is what we do. This is what they do. And the key here, Rebecca, is also to make sure that the communities who are potentially impacted are prepared as well.
Okay. So we're tremendously prepared. Hopefully the other communities are going to be prepared as well prepared as we are. And here they are last week. Oh, we're almost out of money. And that's with another hurricane on the way, by the way. It's going to hit Tampa. So the administration has come in for a lot of criticism that the Federal Emergency Management Association or administration, the Federal Emergency Management Administration was giving money to resettle illegal aliens when it should have been set aside for disaster and storm relief. Karine Jean-Pierre, the worst press secretary ever to exist, is angry and saying that this is absolutely false, that they were using money for illegals instead of putting the money aside for storm relief. Here is what she had to say again last week.
It's just categorically false. No, Biden did not take FEMA relief money to use on migrants.
I want to play that one more time. She, of course, that's not true.
It's just categorically false. No, Biden did not take FEMA relief money to use on migrants.
Okay. I want you to hear what she had to say in September of 2022. Same Karine Jean-Pierre. 2 years ago.
FEMA regional administrators have been meeting with city officials on site to coordinate available federal support from FEMA and other federal agencies. Funding is also available through FEMA's Emergency Food and Shelter Program to eligible local governments and non-for-profit organizations upon request to support humanitarian relief for migrants.
Relief for who? Relief for who? I think I heard her say emergency monies would be available for migrants. Why don't we hear that one again real quickly?
FEMA regional administrators have been meeting with city officials on site to coordinate available federal support from FEMA and other federal agencies. Funding is also available through FEMA's Emergency Food and Shelter Program.
Yes, but for who?
To eligible local governments and non-for-profit organizations upon request to support humanitarian relief for migrants.
Bum, 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 bum.
Oh. So now you have Karine Jean-Pierre saying that what Karine Jean-Pierre had to say is?
It's just categorically false.
Are you going to see CBS play this side by side? No, you're not going to see CBS play this side by side. Are you going to see ABC or NBC? No. PBS? Ha! That's one reason why shows like this are as important as they are. And it's why Again, thank God for Elon Musk's Twitter. Thank God for people, you know, citizen journalists out there doing the work that the credentialed news media don't do. They're not interested. After all, this would make the Kamala Harris campaign look not so good. So there you have two side-by-sides. You have the head of Homeland Security, the most inept, both inept and dishonest. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, who has presided over an unprecedented gusher of illegal entry into the United States by illegals, saying that they had all the money, you know, tremendously prepared, ready for hurricane season just 3 months ago, and now he's pleading poverty. We don't have the money. And then when it's pointed out how they spent that money, how some of that money went bye-bye because it went to illegals, the Biden administration just disgustedly sweeps aside any notion that this could be because of money going to illegals. That's categorically false. Of course, that didn't happen. And there she is 2 years ago explaining how the money would be used to help, quote, migrants, close quote, by FEMA. These people are liars. And again, they're inept. Thank God we have such great state aid from, you know, the states of Florida and Georgia, North Carolina. Thank God we have so much support from organizations like Salvation Army and Samaritan's Purse. Red Cross is out there, and dozens of other organizations. And thank God for all the citizens who are just going around and helping people, and sometimes getting into trouble for helping people. But, you know, anytime you have to lie to cover your tracks, never a good sign. So both on the notion that FEMA was well prepared, and both on the claim that the administration heatedly denying that any FEMA money went to illegals when they were outlining how the money would be spent on illegals just 2 years ago. That just tells you more than you need to know. We need a new administration. This is the Biden-Harris administration at work, so to speak. All right, it's coming up here on 6:48 in the morning, and we're going to check in with our good buddy Lars Larson, our noon to three host, as the commute continues. Good morning. I don't say a little prayer for Lars Larson, but you know, I do care about the guy. I can't
say
wait.
A big prayer for me.
Gets the makeup right every day. He does.
Can't wait to hear what he has to say. Good morning, Lars Larson.
Good morning, John. I hope the weekend treated you well.
It did. It did. I want to play this quick clip from Elon Musk over the weekend, campaigning with Donald Trump in Butler, Pennsylvania, the very spot where Donald Trump was almost assassinated 2.5 months ago. Here's Elon.
You know, the true test of someone's character is how they behave under fire.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And we had one president who couldn't climb a flight of stairs, and another who was fist pumping after getting shot. Fight, fight, fight! Blood coming down the face. Now, America is the home of the brave.
There you go.
Elon Isn't that Musk. Great? Yep.
I just think that's
it. You see him come bouncing out on that stage? I mean,
oh, he's like a kid.
Yeah. He is. And I think he's right that without Trump, we're going to end up without a First Amendment. And we've been, you and I have been warning people about this for a while. John Kerry, 10 days ago, said the former, you know, presidential candidate, Secretary of State, professional gas bag, marries rich women for a living. And now he does, one right after another. And he comes out and says this First Amendment thing gets in the way of governing because we can't work a consistent narrative. Oh, what? That came out of the mouth of somebody who was the Secretary of State and a presidential candidate.
Well, and then his successor as Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, said much the same thing a couple days later, Lars.
Yep. And it should be a warning to people. You know, I understand there are people who listen to you and me and they say, oh, these people are scaremongers and they got their tinfoil hats on too tight. When the other side starts saying it out loud, this First Amendment thing gets in the way of us governing because it allows people in America to have an alternate point of view and alternate information. By the way, the new jobs numbers last week, does anybody believe that garbage that got shoveled out? They've had 11 months of putting out one number and then downsizing it 60 days later.
Yes, 60 days later. Oh, we need to revise. No, the bottom line is what John Kerry said, what Hillary Clinton said, those were fringe points of view a few years ago. Now it's the Democrats' elites who are saying that. I have found the perfect ad to elect Donald Trump president. The perfect ad. All they need to do is run this audio for the next 4 weeks, and Donald Trump wins resoundingly. What audio am I talking about? You're going to hear it here in just about 5 minutes on the John Carlson show. But before we do that, ladies and gentlemen, the University of Washington Huskies unbelievably take down the 10th-ranked football team in the country, the University of Michigan, which defeated the Huskies by 20 points last January for the national championship. Here's how it sounded as the clock expired on the field, Husky Stadium, Saturday evening.
And here come the fans, 27-17, your final at Husky Stadium.
27-17. Well, you know who we got to talk to about this? Our senior sports correspondent here on the commute with Carlson this morning, John Matthew Carlson. Good morning. How you doing, Matt?
Ooh, I'm doing good. I'm sure you're doing good too. After that game, that was pretty historic, pretty incredible to see on Mott Lake on Saturday night.
Unbelievable! It was tied at 17 when the UW marched to the Michigan goal line here.
Jumbo set. Back to Coleman. Over the top. No doubt about this one. Touchdown, Washington.
Oh, I love the toughness.
And then our field goal kicker, Grady Gross, had a tough couple of games leading up to this one, but he kicked another field goal afterwards to ice the victory for the Huskies.
Mm-hmm.
How did this happen, Matthew?
Well, the University of Washington proved a lot of people wrong. Definitely on the schedule, this was the marquee game, a rematch of last year's national championship, albeit against teams that were completely unrecognizable from a personnel standpoint from the last time they played in the Natty. But completely new, two new head coaches, almost completely new offenses and defenses. University of Washington, I think the best way I can say it, they defended their home turf. It was their 18th straight victory on Mott Lake, and they just did a good job against a weakened Michigan team on their third string quarterback. They took full advantage of the opportunity, and kudos to them.
No, it was just outstanding and so surprising because it looked like the Huskies were just full of talent, but they just couldn't put it together. Too many penalties, too many lost opportunities, and they just weren't ready for prime time. And then here we were playing the 10th ranked team in the country prime time on Saturday. Every major national sports pundit, commentator, analyst, etc., who predicted this game predicted a Michigan victory. Everyone that I'm aware of.
The ESPN College Game Day crew, they just went down the line. They said, Michigan, 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 Michigan. It sounded like, you know, a political ad, you know, these days. This was the type of game that makes you believe that you can be a great football team. I mean, this is a Michigan team that was ranked 10th. They'd beaten USC already on the season.
Yeah.
So for the University of Washington to, you know, drop that game to Rutgers and then immediately come back and defend Montlake. And it was one of those games, too, 27-17, where once Grady Gross kicked that field goal, people started to look around and say, oh, my goodness, they're going to win this football game.
And nobody left. 72,000 people in the stands. So, nobody left.
In fact, a lot of folks left their seats after the game and tumbled down onto the field.
Well, yes, they left their seats to rush the field, which rarely happens. But there was just so much euphoria, just absolute euphoria that this happened.
And Tony Castricone, I got to say, I was listening to the game on the radio driving home. He called a great game for the Huskies. He's a great play-by-play guy.
Tony's good people. We've had him on the show before. No, he's a very, very worthy replacement for the legendary Bob Rondeau.
Very. Yes, sir. And you know this going to school there, too. But on the radio, I don't know what – I know, you know, the Seahawks stadium is loud. Husky Stadium gets loud.
Yeah.
That is a loud, loud, loud place.
Yep.
And Michigan's used to loud environments, but this one was not kind to them. So good for the Huskies.
So not only that, some poetic justice as well for the Huskies, because not only do we win, but we defeat Michigan. So that avenges last January. And again, 18 straight victories at home. That's a new record. At least you have to go way, way, way back in time back to
well, John Carlson wasn't a student.
No, that was before that era. Leather football helmet era. Anyway, the coach who abandoned the Huskies after two great successful years so he could coach at Alabama ends up losing.
Now that there are upsets, and this is not to take anything away from the University of Washington, what they did. And then there are monumental upsets. I mean, it was the whole college football universe was transfixed on this game.
Stunned.
Vanderbilt, perpetual punching bag of the SEC, you know, known for kind of a nerdy school, you know, great academics, downtown Nashville, but never, ever particularly known for their football program, beating number one Alabama. That's unbelievable. And 40-35, I was actually watching the game, God bless him, with an Alabama fan who was just beside himself. Vandy Stadium was completely inundated with Alabama fans. But no, Kalen DeBoer goes from beating number one Georgia in one of the most thrilling college football games anyone's ever seen to laying a dozen eggs and losing to Vanderbilt.
Yes. All right.
Here's some crazy stats for you, Dad. Vanderbilt was 0-60 against the top five all time. 0-60. They had a 23-game losing streak to Alabama. They had not beaten Alabama since 1984. And, the students at Vanderbilt tore down the goalposts. and marched him 2.4 miles and threw him in the Cumberland River.
They actually marched with him 2 miles, 2.5 miles.
I heard law enforcement, city officials are trying to go after him now and pay the fine. I don't think they'll have any problem wanting to come up with a fundraiser.
Do a GoFundMe. They'll raise the money for that.
Actually, here's I saw a pretty cool thing. So they threw him in the river, and this is a pretty deep river. Those goalposts sunk. So the fire department fished him out, and they're going to cut up goalposts and sell them off and use that money to pay the fine.
There you go. So,
there you go. That's industrious.
It's still, you know?
Okay, yeah. And while we're talking about laying an egg, just 15 seconds on the Seahawks. Ouch.
And that's all we need. I still believe we're a good football team, but losing 29-20 at the Giants, that was disappointing. The Giants got to Geno Smith that last,
They were 1-3.
Final. Yeah, they're 1-3. Blocking that field goal, running it back for a touchdown was hurts. But the Seahawks got a quick turnaround. They're on Thursday Night Football. Yeah. At home against the San Francisco 49ers.
There we go.
Win against them would still give them division control and show that they are for real.
Yes. So. All right. Matthew Carlson, great review of the most important football games of the weekend, particularly in the college ranks. Thanks ever so much. Let's touch base again soon.
Always a fun time, Dad. Love you, and bless you guys. Have a great day.
All right. Love you too, son. That's our senior sports correspondent.
He makes it so easy to understand all this stuff if you're not a sports person.
That's what he's good at. That's why I want him to do this. He, like I am on politics, he is on sports. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're not a sports station, and some people complain that we talk about sports at all, but mm-hmm. we got to cover the basics.
And to finish it with a dad and son saying, love you, Dad, love you, son. That's gold. Yeah. That's cool.
That's just natural. That's Matthew. Okay. Anyway, it is 7:15. I promised you. I found the perfect ad. The perfect ad for the Trump campaign. If Donald Trump wants to be president, all he needs to do is run this.
Clearly, I am not Joe Biden.
Okay, so that's Kamala Harris making it clear she's not Joe Biden. And then here's Joe Biden last week. Not 2021, not 2022. Last week, he pops up in the press room and starts answering questions. And one of the questions he's asked about Kamala Harris. And listen to what he says about how close their working relationship is.
We're constant contact with her. She's aware we're singing from the same song sheet. She helped pass all the laws that are being employed now.
Oh.
She was a major player in everything we've done.
Major player.
Including passage of legislation which we were told we could never pass. And so she's been... Her staff is interlocked with mine in terms of all the things we're doing.
Staff is
clearly, I am not Joe Biden.
That's your ad.
Singing off the same song sheet.
We're singing off the same song sheet. Our staffs are interlocked. She's played a major role. Again, keep in mind, Kamala Harris is trying to run like the challenger. She's the candidate of change. And, he's an old white guy, and she's a younger woman of color. Other than that, how are you different from him? How are your politics different from him? Because, as she never tires of saying...
Clearly, I am not Joe Biden.
Okay. But then Joe Biden comes in and says,
I'm in constant contact with her. She's aware we're singing from the same song sheet.
Singing from the same song sheet.
She helped pass all the laws that are being employed now.
She helped pass those laws that have on the border, the economy. And okay, that's good to know.
She was a major player and everything we've done, including passage of legislation which we were told we could never pass. And so she's been, and her staff is interlocked with mine in terms of all the things we're doing.
Interlocked, you say?
What's all the things they're doing?
Again, and there's Joe Biden sounding less incoherent than usual. But here he's basically saying, no, she's close to me. We're in constant contact all the time. We're singing off the same song sheet. She played a critical role in passing this legislation. Our staffs are interlocked. Ladies and gentlemen, all the Trump campaign has to do is play that soundbite from Joe Biden. And then at the end, I'm Donald Trump, and I approve this message. And the campaign's over. That is Joe Biden reaffirming what no one in Kamala Harris land wants to acknowledge. That is the role she has played in this administration. So this is, to me, what a gift, what a break. They need to play this over and over again. The media is not going to play it. You have to buy an ad, buy advertising time, and just let people know that Joe Biden, who continues to have very low approval ratings, is saying, yeah, Kamala, she's my gal. She's right there with me, singing off the same song sheet. Our staff's interlocked. Plays a vital role in passing this legislation. In fact, people said we couldn't pass it. I had Kamala there, so we got it passed. Just keep playing that soundbite. It's only about 26 seconds. That's all you need to do is play it. And again, that's not Joe Biden 3 years ago or 2 years ago or even last year. That's Joe Biden last week. So you can't say he's being taken out of context or he was just being polite and just being nice. This is Joe Biden answering questions in the press room last week. And you can bet the media are in no hurry for people to hear those words of Joe Biden. The Bee Gees, they had to exist because Frankie Valli's voice just wasn't high enough, I guess. Anyway.
And Frankie Valli, you hear, 90 years old, still fighting. I want to continue my performances.
Frankie?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's wonderful.
90.
Great Broadway.
Yep.
Great Broadway musical about those guys. Anyway, that is a request from KVI listener Squishy from Tacoma. KVI listener Squishy.
All of a sudden, this Tacoma. Turned into a Casey Kasem top 40 here.
Thank you, Squishy, for a great request from
We're doing Tommy. Pet names now on our song requests.
Squishy, there's long-distance dedication. All right.
We have great listeners, smart listeners, and the greatest names.
Who have strange taste in music.
Multidimensional
anyway.
Hair.
Oh, okay. Fiji's love it.
Go for it, Philip J.
Let's get you one on the campaign in this state for Superintendent of Public Instruction, the social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort.
We like David Olson.
And David Olson is the candidate I'm talking about. He's been pretty active on social media. He posted this message, said, I squared off with Mr. quote, we need a state income tax, end quote, Chris Rakedahl. Yesterday in Bellevue, he continues to refuse any accountability for public schools failing on his watch.
Yeah.
And the income tax is a proposal that Superintendent Rakedahl has proposed as a way to generate more money for Washington Public Schools, even though testing is doing poorly.
I think what David Olson, I mean, speaking of a 30-second ad, a great ad, just say, I think taxpayers have done their part and that we need to deliver better education for the money you're giving us. My opponent wants you to pay a new income tax to keep delivering mediocre education results. That's your choice in November.
As you've pointed out, the homeless industrial complex says, well, we need more money to fix homelessness. And more money has been spent and spent and spent, and yet results do not get any better. And that has been kind of the same call on education in this state. We need more money, and more money has been given, and more money has been spent, but results have really not improved.
Well, and again, it's worse than that, because it used to be liberals would throw money at problems and things wouldn't get better. Now they throw money at things and things get worse.
Yeah. You talked about this almost an hour ago on the show, this question of FEMA money. Where is it going?
Oh, yes.
And the DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas last week saying that FEMA money might run out before hurricane season ends here at the end of this month. So J.D. Vance was on with Fox and Friends this morning, and he had a couple of things to say about this. Let's start with the first line that he had. This was his response to this whole disconnect that FEMA might be running out of money. Here's J.D. Vance.
First of all, you have to separate what people are saying. They'll say, well, there's a bucket of money in FEMA that's gone to illegal aliens, and that's somehow separate than the bucket of money that should by right go to American citizens. I think that misses the fundamental point that the Biden-Harris administration has turned FEMA effectively into an agency that helps to resettle and helps to deal with illegal immigration. That is just fundamentally going to distract focus from their core job of helping American citizens in their time of need.
So if I'm hearing him correctly, he's saying that this is all mission creep.
Great
brought
point.
On by the open border situation.
Not even mission creep.
Unchecked border.
It's a mission shift. We're no longer in the emergency management. We no longer exist to help Americans during times of emergency. We now exist to resettle illegals who have entered this country illegally.
Yeah.
So that's not just bracket or mission creep. That's just a new,
like you said,
type of entity, a new kind of organization.
Paradigm shift, right? And then J.D. Vance went on to talk about the slow response that the Biden administration is getting criticized for as it relates to the flash flooding, the natural disasters, Hurricane Helene. And he kind of gives a comparison of how he thinks things would go with a Trump administration.
The problem here, I really believe, is just it's like the DMV at industrial scale. And because of it, a lot of folks in North Carolina are suffering unnecessarily. I hope to God you don't have unnecessary loss of life, but I fear that we do. And it all goes back to, why do we have a president and a vice president, one of whom is on the beach, the other of whom is participating in fundraisers rather than doing their job? It is incompetence of the highest order. And what Donald Trump would do if he was president is impose real leadership, force the bureaucracy to be responsive, not at a bureaucratic pace, but at a business pace to the needs of American citizens. That's how you save lives and limit needless suffering.
If Trump he's good.
Yeah, if Trump can mobilize it that way, that would make a big difference.
He is good. All right, J.D. Vance. That is our social media sweep. Hour number two, The John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. When we come back, how is this election looking by the numbers? Steve Kornacki from, of all places, MSNBC has some interesting updates, and you're going to hear him. Right after.
Great shot of Mount Rainier for driving in this morning.
I know.
You've been on Mount Adams. Any comment about the sudden earthquakes up there?
Well, I mean, it's right there in the same nerve center as St. Helens.
Yeah, like right in the shadow.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I remember once when I was climbing Mount Adams, I looked over. Sun was rising, and there is this huge gray shadow.
Yeah.
That starts to come to life, and it's St. Helens. Rainier, believe it or not, is still an active volcano. Mm-hmm. So we hadn't seen this kind of seismic activity out of Mount Adams in quite some time.
Yeah, and it was after Mount St. Helens, about 2 years later, everybody said, let's get more monitoring on the mountains. We'll watch the Lahars on Rainier, Baker. Glacier Peak's another one they watch.
Yeah.
Anyway, the concern is every 2 or 3 years, there's maybe one quake on Mount Adams.
Yeah.
6 earthquakes, magnitudes between 0.9 and 2.0 in the month of September. So we're adding a little more watch.
Yes. One more thing to keep our eye on out there. So over the weekend, Donald Trump returned to Butler, Pennsylvania. This is the site of where he was very nearly killed, where he was shot in the ear, but had he not turned his head just at the right time, that bullet would have gone through his head, would have killed him. So why did he return to Butler? I think he did it for two reasons. Number one, to make a point. Number two, to pay tribute to those who were wounded and to Corey Camporator, who lost his life. This is the retired firefighter, fire chief, actually, who... lost his life, shot in the head while trying to cover his wife and children, wife and daughters. And so that was one reason. The other reason he was going is, hey, it's Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania is the key state for the Republicans. If they win Pennsylvania, Electoral College, if they win Pennsylvania, they will win the election. And if Kamala Harris had been thinking clearly, instead of listening to the left wing, the progressive wing of her party, she would have chosen the pretty popular governor of that state, Josh Shapiro, to be her running mate. Instead, she goes with Tim Walz of Minnesota, and, well, you saw at the debate how that has worked out for them. But the bottom line here is, for Republicans, it's a want-to-have. For Democrats, it's a got-to-have. They can't win without Pennsylvania. They've got to have Pennsylvania. And so... both parties spending a lot of time. You would think that Trump and Kamala Harris were running for statewide office in Pennsylvania. They've spent so much time there. And they're going to continue spending time there because this is the state that matters most to determining the outcome. If there is one state where if it goes one way, if it goes to Trump, then Trump's going to win. And there's really nothing the Democrats can do. If it goes to Kamala Harris, then Republicans have got to scramble in order to win. So Steve Kornacki, MSNBC pollster, looked at the state of Pennsylvania and said, here is why it has become so competitive. Have a listen.
Taking a closer look then at the Keystone State, one of the reasons, besides its size, that this is of such interest to Trump and the Republicans, there's a trend here. You're looking at the Trump era. You're looking at party registration in Pennsylvania. And look at this. When Donald Trump first came on the scene, you know, back in 2016, the Democratic advantage in party registration in Pennsylvania was over 900,000 votes. 2020, look now, in 2024, that's been cut almost in two-thirds there, down to about 330,000. There's been a little bit of a boost for Democrats since Kamala Harris took over in registration, but the big picture trend here has been more competitive for Republicans in party registrations.
So here's what he's talking about regarding the numbers. In 2016, Donald Trump narrowly won the state of Pennsylvania, even though Democrats had an advantage of 900,000 registered voters. In other words, there were more than 900,000 more Democrats, more voters who were registered as Democrats than Republicans. in 2020, an election that Joe Biden won in Pennsylvania, though it was narrow. He did win, and the advantage had been in registration. Still, Democrats dominated, but Republicans had it down to about 500,000 or so. A Democratic advantage of 500,000 or so. Now it's down to 333,000. Or to put it plainly, there were 900,000 more Democrats than Republicans registered to vote in Pennsylvania in 2016. Now there are only 333,000 or so more Democrats than Republicans. And many of those Democrats, blue-collar, working-class Democrats, who are the kind of Democrats who voted for Ronald Reagan in 1980. They did not vote for Hillary Clinton, but they voted for Biden. Next door, Delaware, kind of comes off as, used to come off as more of a working class kind of guy, regular guy. But now it's Kamala. And I got to tell you, if the Republicans pull off a victory there, then everything goes their way. Not only that, the Democrats have all but thrown in the towel on keeping control of the United States Senate. They've got a 51-49 advantage. They are going to lose the state of West Virginia. It's not even a close call. They've all but conceded it. So now it's 50-50. So the Republicans need to win one state. And it looks like they have the possibility of winning three, maybe four, especially Montana. Tim Sheehy has now been ahead in every poll over John Tester, who looks like a Republican, got a crew cut, but in a big brawny kind of guy, but he votes, well, like Tim Walz looks kind of like a Republican guy, but votes like Jay Inslee. And is much more close to Pramila Jayapal than to your average Montana voter. So anyway, the news for Republicans on the Senate front is increasingly encouraging. The House continues to be a complete toss-up and a slight edge being given to Democrats currently. So we're going to have a very busy election night here. And by the way, I maybe don't want to get too far out in front of myself, but did want you to know that there's going to be an election watch party, and KVI is going to be right in the red hot center of it at the Bellevue Hyatt. So if you want to come watch the election returns, not just the presidential race, but all the major races for the House and Senate, some governor races in there as well, you want to be with us on election night at the Grand Hyatt Hotel in Bellevue. So put that on your calendar. Just a little less, you know, little less than 1 month, 4 weeks away, and we'll all be out there together. We're going to be broadcasting live. That's going to be a busy, busy time. All right, it is coming up here on Boeing Time, The Commute with Carlson, 7:47. Still have so much new stuff we got to bring you here on The Commute, including some problems in Kamala Harris's running mate's home state. It helps explain why, when he joined the ticket, Minnesota voters, even though it's a Democratic state, actually support for Kamala Harris went down instead of up when she added Tim Walz to the ticket. What, I'm going to hold this this story about Tim Walz, which, by the way, is from CNN, because I wanted to play. I've been doing a series of side-by-side stories where you have members of the Kamala Harris, Joe Biden administration saying one thing at one time and another thing at another time that completely, completely upends and discredits what they are saying now. We got the same thing with Kamala Harris. She was doing an interview late last week about being asked about fracking, where she's changed her position. And the interviewer wanted to know why she had changed.
I wanted to ask you, there's a political ad on TV from a 2019 climate hall town meeting that you had, in which you basically said, quote, "There's no question I'm in favor of banning fracking," unquote.
There's no question I'm in favor of banning fracking. So, yeah.
The ad claims that if you're elected president, you will ban fracking and you will cost Pennsylvania over 300,000 jobs. Have you changed your view on fracking? And if so, why?
So let me start by saying that that ad, as you described it, is absolutely a mischaracterization that I think is intended to make people afraid of my presidency. Let me be absolutely clear, as I've been when I said it back in 2020. I will not ban fracking. I did not as vice president. In fact, I cast the tie-breaking vote to open up more fracking leases. And my perspective on this is grounded in a number of things.
And again, you heard her say in 2019, there's no question that I oppose fracking. So here is where she who was mischaracterizing her remarks. Not the ad. It was she who mischaracterized her remarks. After she was named to the ticket, whenever she spoke in places like Pennsylvania or Ohio, which, again, is fracking country, whenever she spoke in these places, she said that Joe Biden will not allow fracking. She didn't say that she changed her mind. Instead, she just left that aside and said, Joe Biden will not allow, will not ban fracking. She still hasn't explained why she has changed her mind. And I think the media should insist, this reporter probably didn't know the backstory, should insist that she explain why she's changed her mind on this and several other major issues like socialized takeover of healthcare. Why has she changed her position? Explain yourself. And get ready for hour number three of The Commute. It's sunshine. It's already hour number three of the John Carlson Show. Talk Radio 570 KVI. Man, what an eventful day we have had. And of course, this is Monday, October 7th, the 1 year anniversary of the savage attack on Israeli civilians. And not just Israeli civilians, people visiting Israel as well, and some military personnel and law enforcement who were trying to defend the people, civilians who were being attacked and sometimes savagely tortured, particularly women, before 251 were taken back over the border. Most of them alive. Some of them were taken over the border already dead. Israel, 1 year later, is annihilating Hamas's leadership. Hamas was the terror entity that was governing a homeland, if you will. A strip of land roughly as long as the distance between Seattle and Federal Way, or Seattle and near Everett up north. They had 25 miles of Mediterranean beachfront. They had the potential to turn their homeland into a tourist mecca, no pun intended. But instead, they plowed almost all of their foreign aid into building a network of tunnels, 350 miles worth of tunnels, and use Gaza as a staging base for raiding and launching mortars and rockets into southern Israel. And then October 7th, an absolute invasion. 1 year later, what do things look like? Well, the good news is that they're winning this war in Gaza. The bad news is the United States, while initially in the early goings, was very supportive. As soon as they received a political backlash from the left wing of the Democratic Party, the progressive wing of the Democrats, and the Muslim community, which is very vocal and numerous in Michigan, another state the Democrats absolutely must take if they want to prevail in the Electoral College next month's election, they began to change their tune and began to be very critical. David Friedman, who was Trump's ambassador to Israel, the U.S. ambassador during the Trump era, said that here is what the Harris-Biden administration has been getting wrong. He said, quote, "There's been a huge disconnect between the platitudes and the facts on the ground. For instance, you'll hear a statement repeatedly from Kamala Harris saying Israel has the right to defend itself, which is essentially a meaningless statement. There's no country in the world that doesn't have the right to defend itself. When you look at the policy toward Iran, when you look at the refunding, Iran is, of course, the financial underwriter and the trainer of Hamas. It was basically the attack on Israel was an Iranian operation done with Hamas as the fighters. So that's why he mentions Iran. When you look at the refunding of the United Nations Refugee Relief Organization, which, by the way, had several of their employees taking part in the October 7th attacks, and most others who were cheering the attacks. When you look at the constant interfering with Israel's prosecution of its defense, that famous line of Kamala Harris where she said, I've read the maps. Israel can't go into Rafah, which is southern Gaza. He said, I could have drawn the map on a napkin. It's as if she had undertaken some major academic effort. Of course, Netanyahu, to his credit, didn't listen to them, and he went into Rafah. Had he not gone in, he wouldn't have saved five hostages. he wouldn't have discovered the smuggling tunnels from Egypt into Gaza that were the primary source of Hamas's weapons. So they will say enough to placate the most naive and least informed and most insecure members of the Jewish community. But when it comes to actually helping Israel win the war, they've caused Israel to be delayed by months. I think this war in Gaza would have been over many months ago. They've caused Israel to take efforts that I think no army would have taken, putting their soldiers at greater risk and exposing them to death and being injured. This guy has it exactly right. He's correct to point out that Israel could not have defeated Hamas without going in on the ground against them. And, of course, when they go on the ground, these Hamas, who are not barbarians, but are also cowards, they hide behind their own people. They hide behind literally behind their own women and children. There's no honor to these people whatsoever. But we're a year out. In that year, Israel has decimated Hamas's army. They've seized much of their equipment. They've completely taken control of the tunnels. They've destroyed much of their leadership. The one guy still out there, and it's not clear if he's even still alive, is Yahya Sinwar. He's the Bin Laden. He's the tip of the spear. He is the architect of the October 7th slaughter. So that's the good news. Hamas has been deeply degraded. And now they're going to have to look to see if they can find someone to take Hamas's place. It's important that Hamas be annihilated so that they will be an example. Don't even bother going after Israel. This is how you end up. And ditto with Hezbollah. But you know where this is all going eventually. Israel has attacked and is eviscerating Hamas. They are decapitating the leadership of Hezbollah, the terror organization up north of Israel. And they've now gone after the Houthi rebels in Yemen. All three of these groups are like Al-Qaeda, the people who attacked us on 9/11. They hate the West. They hate freedom. And they don't mind killing as many as possible. And the idea that there would be a Jewish homeland in the Middle East, particularly where there's always been a Jewish homeland in Jerusalem, at least since the time of King David, is to them the ultimate insult, because in order to show their superiority over the Jew, they must control the Holy Land. They must control Jerusalem. It would be like someone who hates Muslims insisting on taking over Mecca so that they will know that they are that they are ruled, that they are dominated by those who hate Islam. Now, of course, you don't hear Jews saying we should take Mecca or Medina. You don't hear Christians saying that either. But you do hear Muslims not only insisting from the river to the sea that when they say Palestine will be free, what they mean is it'll be free of Jews. Kamala Harris on 60 Minutes. This is going to air in its entirety tonight. Here are a couple of excerpts of what she has to say about Israel that we thought very appropriate to air on the first anniversary of October 7th. This is Kamala talking with Bill Whitaker, kind of the easygoing correspondent for CBS. Kamala Harris last night on America's Principles in the Middle East. See if you can navigate this word salad you're about to hear.
We supply Israel with billions of dollars in military aid. Mm-hmm. And yet Prime Minister Netanyahu seems to be charting his own course. The Biden-Harris administration has pressed him to agree to a ceasefire. He's resisted. You urged him not to go into Lebanon. He went in anyway. He has promised to make Iran pay for the missile attack, and that has the potential of expanding the war. Does the U.S. have no sway over Prime Minister Netanyahu?
The aid that we have given Israel allowed Israel to defend itself against 200 ballistic missiles that were just meant to attack the Israelis and the people of Israel. And when we think about the threat that Hamas, Hezbollah presents, Iran, I think that it is without any question our imperative to do what we can to allow Israel to defend itself against those kinds of attacks.
Again, to get back to Ambassador Friedman, what kind of statement is that? It's utterly meaningless. Every country has the right to defend itself. So she's acting like we're making a major statement and saying, yes, Israel, you have a right to defend yourself.
Now, the work that we do diplomatically with the leadership of Israel is an ongoing pursuit around making clear our principles, which include the need for humanitarian aid, the need for this war to end, the need for a deal to be done, which would release the hostages and create a ceasefire. And we're not going to stop.
Okay, have you noticed that her, quote, principles, close quote, are in direct conflict with each other? We need this war to end. So therefore, we want a ceasefire. Ceasefire doesn't end a war. A ceasefire prolongs a war. A ceasefire, in the case of Gaza, where she didn't want them going into Rafah, thank God they did. They weren't going to win the war if they didn't go into Rafah. And yet here we were, taking the side of Hamas and telling them not to go into Rafah. They ignored her. Good for them. And have a ceasefire. If Israel hadn't agreed to previous ceasefires that were all but imposed on them by America, this war would have been over. Would have been over. Would have been done. So if you want the war to end, you notice she didn't say, we want Israel to win. Did you catch that? She didn't say she wanted victory for Israel. She didn't say she wanted them to defeat Hamas. She wanted the war to end with a ceasefire, which, of course, gives Hamas time to regroup and rearm. So she's either stupid or she really isn't on Israel's side. Flip a coin on that one. And then she goes further by refusing to call Benjamin Netanyahu an ally of this country.
But it seems that Prime Minister Netanyahu is not listening.
Well, Bill, the work that we have done has resulted in a number of movements in that region by Israel that were very much prompted by or a result of many things, including our advocacy for what needs to happen in the region.
What did she just say? I've listened to this several times. What on earth was she even saying there? Anyway, let's continue.
Do we have a real close ally in Prime Minister Netanyahu?
I think, with all due respect, the better question is, do we have an important alliance between the American people and the Israeli people? And the answer to that question is yes.
Yeah, well, you don't have an alliance with people. You have an alliance with a country and its government. The people of Israel have selected Benjamin Netanyahu several times, by the way, to be their prime minister. So you can't be allied with a people and not be allied with the government. You are either a friend or foe, or you can say, well, we're right now kind of an adversary. Well, right now we're kind of neutral. This is no time to be neutral. Benjamin Netanyahu, whenever he's disagreed with the Americans, he had it right, we had it wrong. It is clear that the Israelis don't have confidence in the American government, and they don't trust the American government on the Middle East. Neither do I. I'm so embarrassed for our country that our government is this inept and this absurd when they are dealing with high-stakes consequences for getting it wrong in the Middle East. Morning. Philip J. Vandervoort, the third, your favorite segment of the day, social media from Socialists. What do you got?
Yep. Local campaign news, the race for governor here in Washington, the social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. Bob Ferguson running for governor, and he posted on his social media handle, big news. Hours after being endorsed by the Everett Herald today, we received the endorsement of the Tri-City Herald. We're building a broad coalition across the state, and we're fighting for all of Washington. Now, off the top of my head, I haven't looked, but I'm going to guess that the Spokane newspaper will probably endorse Ferguson. The Seattle Times already has, although they give a very tepid endorsement, to say the least. So I guess it's safe to say that the big newspapers across Washington want the status quo if they want Bob Ferguson to be their endorsement for governor of Washington.
All of these newspapers, actually what they're looking at is they think Ferguson is going to win, so let's just throw our chips behind him. Uh-huh. Here's the bottom line. All of these newspapers have complained about the excesses and extremism of the legislature. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. of course, with the majority Democrats still going to control both houses, everyone concedes that next session. You need a governor who will check and balance, who will be a break mm-hmm. on the legislature. And that would be, obviously, Dave Reichert. Mm-hmm. Ferguson, he would just put his foot on the accelerator.
Sure would.
So none of these newspapers have even acknowledged that obvious fact, that one of those candidates would be a break and the other would aid and abet more of the extremism that these newspapers are complaining about.
Yeah. Over on MSNBC/NBC for Meet the Press over the weekend, Andrea Mitchell, one of the longtime reporter/anchors at NBC and MSNBC.
Long time. She was there when Harry Truman was in the White House.
Okay. She told the panel yesterday on Meet the Press, that it's, I think she made up a word. She said the word miscegenation, and I didn't know that that was a nation, but I think she was trying to get after the word misogyny. Mm-hmm. Misogyny was a factor in why Kamala Harris is polling so low among men, both black and white. Now, listen to this clip from Andrea Mitchell.
What I'm hearing from Democratic and Republican business people and a lot of men, and she's got such a big problem with men. I think there's an undercount of the Trump vote. I think there is misogynation in all of this, black and white men. Big problem, but also the business world. They don't think she is serious. They don't think she's a heavyweight. And a lot of this is gender, but she's got to be more specific about her economic plans.
Maybe we should direct Andrea Mitchell to that bang-up clip you were playing in the last segment from 60 Minutes. And why Kamala Harris isn't regarded as a heavyweight when she's forced to ask questions about Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, the war against Hamas, what's happening with Hamas in Gaza.
Well, let me ask this. Does this mean that when there's a gender gap in the, where women, there's a gender gap where women favor one candidate proportionally over another, that it's because these women hate men?
Women hating men, potentially?
In other words, are there's a gender gap nationally in favor of Kamala Harris.
Mm-hmm.
Is this because women who support Harris hate men?
Maybe so.
Because people say, no, that's ridiculous. And yet listen to Andrea Mitchell at age 114.
I mean, chalk this up as another example.
Oh, it's miscegenation.
Of you pointing out that all of these biases always go in one direction.
One direction.
Either against a Republican or against Trump or against a conservative. So,
because she's mainstream. You're listening to The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. In the morning, nice sunny morning it is. Tell you, the weather this weekend was, last weekend was just wonderful.
Wait till you see what's going on later today. 75 and warmer, especially in the South Sound today.
That will be nice. Welcome back, everybody. The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Want to play a couple of side-by-side clips, which tell you everything you need to know about how candid and how competent this administration is. We're going to start with Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. This is the guy who has presided over the biggest wave of illegal immigration in national history, and he helped make it happen. One of the portfolios that he has as Department of Homeland Security is FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Association. These are the people who are supposed to show up when there's a disaster on the ground, natural disaster, hurricane, tornado, flooding, etc. Here is what he had to say about whether we were ready for hurricane season or not just a couple of months ago in July.
FEMA is tremendously prepared. This is what we do. This is what they do. And the key here, Rebecca, is also to make sure that the communities who are potentially impacted are prepared as well. And it's not just hurricanes and fire, wildfires, also extreme heat, which certainly some parts of the United States are already experiencing.
So, we're not only prepared, we're tremendously prepared, and boy, we hope the locals are prepared as well. We hope they're on the ball like we are, because we're ready, not just for hurricane season, but also for things like wildfires and extreme heat that's right in front of us here during the summer. Okay, that was 2 months ago, 3 months ago. Here's Alejandro Mayorkas last week.
Jerry, Alejandro Mayorkas sounding the alarm on FEMA funding right after the devastation of Hurricane Helene. Listen.
We are meeting the immediate needs with the money that we have. We are expecting another hurricane hitting. We do not have the funds. FEMA does not have the funds to make it through the season.
This all comes as the Biden-Harris administration spent over $1 billion from a FEMA program on services for migrants.
Okay, so we were tremendously prepared for hurricane season in July. Now we're in hurricane season, and another one on the way here. You've got, as they call it, the mean season down in Florida, and it's headed for Tampa. And it's expected it may not dissolve into a tropical storm, but may continue hurricane strength throughout its trek through Tampa as it heads back out to the ocean. But the bottom line is all of a sudden we're out of money. And there are allegations that FEMA was spending money on services to, quote, migrants. In other words, instead of being focused on being an emergency management association for American citizens, it had expanded its mission to be handle resettlement for people in the country illegally who aren't supposed to be settled here at all. This came up. Karine Jean-Pierre, press secretary, Biden administration. Here is how she reacted when she was asked about that point blank, that you're short of money to help Americans because they spent money on helping illegals.
It's just categorically false. No, Biden did not take FEMA relief money to use on migrants.
Okay, I'm going to play that again. She says it's categorically false, and she specifies what is false.
It's just categorically false. No, Biden did not take FEMA relief money to use on migrants.
He did not take FEMA money to use on migrants. Categorically false. I want you to listen to this same Karine Jean-Pierre 2 years ago, September of 2022.
FEMA regional administrators have been meeting with city officials on site to coordinate available federal support from FEMA and other federal agencies. Funding is also available through FEMA's emergency food and shelter program to eligible local governments and non-for-profit organizations upon request to support humanitarian relief for migrants.
Support humanitarian relief for who? For migrants. For migrants. That is what she said. So, which Karine Jean-Pierre do we believe? Which one was telling the truth? Well, I think she was telling the truth back then. So the claim that the Biden administration, of course he wasn't using money. Well, you said he was 2 years ago, and now you're saying that such a thing.
FEMA regional administrators have been meeting with city officials.
Is categorically.
It's just categorically false. No, Biden did not.
Oh. Well, apparently not. Thought you'd find that enlightening. And they're not going to be playing this on any of the major networks, obviously. And it's too bad because they should. All right, Donald Trump over the weekend, speaking in the town of Juneau, not a Juneau, Alaska, in Juneau, Wisconsin, where he is talking about the issue of illegal immigration and the impact that it has had on American citizens.
An illegal alien released by Kamala Harris was arrested for tying up and blindfolding a 12-year-old, you know this, you read it, it's a big story, a 12-year-old girl in the back of a van and viciously assaulting her in so many ways, sexually. Today I make you this promise, I will liberate Wisconsin and our entire nation from this mass migration invasion of murderers, child predators, drug dealers, gang members, and thugs. Gonna be liberated, gonna liberate.
Listen to that rolling applause. I tell you, in a state like Wisconsin, in a state like Pennsylvania, in a state like Michigan, that's what they respond to. Who is going to actually do something about the illegal immigration? Not just seal the border. What about the problem we've already got here? It's very simple. One of the candidates is going to deport people who have entered this country illegally. The other candidate is going to try and give them a pathway to citizenship. That's what's at stake. Have you registered to vote? Is there anyone in your orbit, friends, family, who is not yet registered to vote? Get them registered. This is all about turnout, whether they live here or whether they live elsewhere. Make sure they're registered. All right. That was Donald Trump yesterday in Wisconsin. The previous day, he was in Butler, Pennsylvania. Butler, Pennsylvania, returning to the scene of where he was nearly assassinated, where he was shot winged in the ear and defiantly thrust his fists in the air and yelled, "Fight, fight, fight." While he spoke in Pennsylvania, so again, he paid great tribute to the people who helped save his life and also to the people who were, there were two people hospitalized with bullet wounds. And of course, Corey Camporator, the retired firefighter who was killed, shielding his family from bullets, he was shot in the head. And a special guest was there. Elon Musk showed up at the Trump rally in Butler, Pennsylvania, to make the case for Trump. Here is Elon Musk in Butler.
You know, the true test of someone's character is how they behave under fire. And we had one president who couldn't climb a flight of stairs, and another who was fist pumping after getting shot. Fight, fight, fight. Blood coming down the face. Now, America is the home of the brave.
Home of the brave. You can't rehearse something like, now, Mr. Trump, if you're ever shot and you're not too badly wounded, here is what you should do. No. That's just instinct. That's something that comes from within. That's your heart. So Elon Musk has it correct. This is how you know. This is your test of a president. This is someone who you know is not going to shrink from a fight or a battle. Interestingly, Trump, by making it clear that he was willing to use force, and several times he did, nevertheless kept this country out of war. Kept this country out of war.
John, it's just so weird. I mean, back in July, you're talking 2.5 months, but real quick. Bigger crowds for this over the weekend? What'd you hear?
I saw one report that there was 100,000 people in Butler. It was a huge, I mean, the papers said, here's how to get there, here's when to avoid, you know, the time. It was just a massive outpouring of people. If you've seen the overhead photos. A couple of months ago, I told you that a very good friend of mine and this station and everybody who ever knew him, Charlie Gouge, passed away from a brain tumor that he had valiantly fought the day after he turned 57. And there was a wonderful memorial service on the peninsula where he grew up, Port Angeles. And on Friday, there was another reception, another celebration of Charlie's life here on the West Side. And his wife, Tanya, daughters were there, and you know his parents are still with us as well. I'll tell you something. I felt so happy for his family to see the many hundreds of people who turned out for Charlie Gouge to give him a hearty farewell. A great guy. He left us way too soon, but boy, so many people wanted to be there to wish him farewell in his new home in heaven. Let's talk again tomorrow on The Commute with Carlson.